for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The mass killings inside a Connecticut elementary school last Friday have touched off numerous questions about our nation's gun laws, mental health services, and also about safety in schools. Schools are among the safest place for kids to be. But some people are asking whether more can or should be done. Joining me to talk about school safety, Lucinda Roy. She's professor at Virginia Tech, David Osher at the American Institutes for Research, and joining us from Virginia, Christine Baylor, coordinator for safety and security at Henrico County Public Schools. I do invite you to join the conversation. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. First, joining us by phone from Cleveland, Ohio, is Ken Trump. He's a school security consultant. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you.
Ken, talk about the elementary school in Connecticut. It seemed to have a very sound safety system in place. Would you agree?
Well, what they had in place in Connecticut is at Sandy Hook is fairly standard for what we see at the elementary school levels since Columbine. The camera buzzer intercom at the front door, your other door is locked. Your staff trained on some basic drills, lockdowns, evacuations, police that are trained in active shooters. And I think what I'm hearing now across the country, Diane, is that parents feel because they had those things at Sandy Hook and still had a tragedy, parents are feeling hopeless and helpless and powerless. And I think we need to take a different angle in looking at this in that, yes, one life lost is terrible. But parents need to have some conversations with their school principals to find out what they have. Most schools have many positive prevention efforts, relationships with kids, counselors, psychologists, which we need more of, and as well as some basic security measures and emergency planning. And I would say that while we did not get the outcome and one life lost is one too many, I think that because of those steps that the school had in place at Sandy Hook, it probably prevented even a greater loss of life, Diane.
But, Ken, is what you're saying that even with all those security elements in place, it could not prevent what happened? What are you, if anything, suggesting needs to be done further?
Well, there are some things that we need to do. I'm a father, first of all, of two elementary age kids, so my 25 plus years of school safety experience went out the door as I got a punch in the gut that Friday. I was actually on my own kids' playground volunteering, supervising safety at recess time. And I think that what we need to do is not necessarily throw out the playbook of best practices on prevention, security, and preparedness, but to focus on the fundamentals. We've had an enormous amount of budget cuts from federal government to eliminate a lot of the prevention funding, the security, the school cops in schools, to secure our schools for equipment. They eliminated the school emergency planning grant, which was unbelievable. I testified to Congress three times on these issues, and they still eliminated. So we need to go back and look at some reasonable funding, recognizing there's no blank check. But at the building levels, we also have a competition for time. I have counselors and prevention staff that tell me that even when they're in the buildings, they have a hard time getting access to kids because of the focus on test scores. So we're competing for time and money. We need the leadership at the building level and to make safety a priority and prevention and security and practicing our drills. But then we also need the resources put back in some reasonable grant funding to stimulate this. But we need to focus on those fundamentals. I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel. We need to just do what we know needs to be done.
Do you believe, as Bill Bennett, former Secretary of Education, has suggested, that there needs to be an armed guard in each and every school.
I strongly support what's known as school resource officer programs. School-based police officers, that's your certified trained police officer from a local or county law enforcement or state law enforcement agency. But I believe that most teachers want to be armed with textbooks and computers, not firearms. And I think we need to provide some resources to help with that school policing function where in those districts that need it. I don't know that even if I think as a parent, every parent would like to have not only an officer in every school, but one officer per child, just for our emotional safety. And I understand that, but I think that we need to, even if we had the money, Diane, think about it. Even if we had an unlimited pool of money, the implementation of that, getting trained police officers, getting the manpower, making sure you sustain that 5 years or 10 years down the road. I mean, look at what happened to Columbine over 13 years ago. We had major national dialogue. We were all excited and moving on prevention, building relationships with kids, on improving security and emergency planning. And here we are in the last 5 or 6 years where the conversation has not been as intense and consistent, and the funding has dissipated for all of the above. So we're a roller coaster society. We have roller coaster public awareness, policy, and funding on these issues, and we need sustainability. And I question how, even if we got the initial funds, we would be able to sustain that over time. Now, that's certainly not a relief to parents who want say there is no price on saving my kid, but I think we need to take a balanced approach, focus on the fundamentals. I do think support school police, and we can need to take those officers. Right now, they've been whittled down so much that when they're in school districts, they're only at the high school or middle school level. Make some funds available to have officers at least rove around in a district, dedicated officers to work with elementaries on prevention, on security measures, advising them on local issues, but not necessarily, you might not be able to put them in the building every day. And I don't support arming non-law enforcement people in school.
So considering Columbine and considering what happened last Friday, what do you expect will change?
Well, I tell you what I'm cautious about and worried about are two things. One is overreaction in terms of unrealistic expectations. My email box is now at about 347 messages in the last day, and some of the titles, as I look at them while I'm speaking with you, are bulletproof vests for teachers, bulletproof backpacks for children, teaching our kids to throw pencils and iPods and attack armed intruders. That's what we don't need. We need to go back and focus on the fundamentals, and I hope our legislators will take a look at all the cuts that they've made, restore some of the things that work. Don't reinvent the wheel. Schools do need some funding for, I've heard talk about fortifying doors and security equipment and those type of things. Our school buildings are in horrible condition across the country. Doors with all glass, doors that even have locks that you close, and if you pull hard enough, they'll pop open. I think it's going to have an enormous cost. I don't know how we'd ever be able to fund all of that from outside. But I do think we need to do some training on our staff on basic security, talk about how they can build the physical security into their capital improvement budgets over time, make sure, I think the government can help support that, but I think at the local level, principals and superintendents need to be talking with their school community about the things they have in place. Many of our schools in this country are doing the right things. They're just not communicating ahead of time. I mean, we've actually built in on the training that we do a whole component on crisis and regular communications about safety for principals because they're not telling parents what they're doing. And what happens is parents are afraid of the unknown, and fear is best managed by education, communication, and preparation. When parents hear from school officials what they're doing on prevention, on security, on preparedness, the parents are less anxious, less alarmed, and get more back into a pragmatic, practical framework rather than an emotional one. And that's how we need to make our decisions now. We need to be thinking rationally, as hard as it is. I have to pull back my father gut instincts here with my two little kids and say, what's reasonable, what's realistic, what's practical, what can we do now? And I think that we need to put it on the front burner. I mean, we know, you're talking, look at the mental health issues, Diane. out here today. Look at the shootings in the malls, in places of worship, in theaters. It's hard for a principal to predict when that type of person, a stranger to the school perhaps, is going to walk across the schoolhouse doors. So you have to have some type of security and preparedness measures. But we can't forget that many of the incidents we've dealt with over the years also come from within, with kids that have mental health issues and need help as well.
Ken Trump, I must say, you sound fairly pessimistic.
Well, I tell you what. I'm pessimistic in. It's not being an alarmist type pessimist. It's just my faith in the political process, in the political aspect. I mean, in my book, I have a chapter on the politics, as I call it, politics of school safety. And perhaps my biggest pessimism is not in what's going on the front lines, but the support that we give to our educators to get those resources and to keep safety on the front burner. I mean, what happens is, on a daily basis, the urgent drives out the important. When principals are pressured to worry about test scores, education reform, budget and facility issues, plus the day-to-day problems and concerns kids bring across the door, the urgent, which is school safety, gets pushed out, which is school safety, gets pushed out by all these other urgent issues. And my pessimism, if any, is in the fact that we need to have consistent leadership in our districts that keeps this on the front burner, and also consistent leadership from our politicians. I guess to sum it up in a nutshell, for all of the calls that I've had and emails in the last few days from people who want to review their emergency plans, who want to know where they can get resources for prevention, who want to talk security and do training, my question in my heart was, where were you this time last week before the crisis? Why weren't we talking about it?
Kenneth Trump, he is president of National School Safety Services. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
Here with me in the studio as we continue our discussion about school safety, David Osher. He's vice president of the American Institute for Research, and Lucinda Roy. She's an alumni and distinguished professor at Virginia Tech, author of the novel Lady Moses, and several books of poetry. And joining us by phone, Christine Baylor. She's coordinator for safety and security at the Henrico County, Virginia Public Schools. David Osher, what was your reaction to Ken Trump's comments?
I think Ken's talk about going back to fundamentals is correct. And I think we have to think about the fact that fundamentals are not just the hardware security fundamentals, but they're also the fundamentals of prevention. And that's what we do universally in a school and also in a community to make it much less likely that young people and adults will behave inappropriately and, in some rare cases, dangerously. And at the same time, have interventions in place, particularly mental health interventions, that are easy, accessible, timely for young people, for their families if they notice the fact that their young people are troubled, as well as for, if we think about in a community, for adults and their families who also may be seeing warning signs. That, as Ken Trump said, in the 90s, when we had the wave of rage shootings, there was public focus on it. I think the government did very reasonable things regarding a combination of a focus on security on the one hand, but a three-tiered approach to prevention and intervention, trying to link mental health services in place. I think that Sandy Hook actually not only had the elements of physical safety, it also had the very important elements, and I'm a grandfather right now thinking about my seven grandkids, of emotional safety. It was a responsive classroom school, from what I can gather. So every day students were in class meetings with their teachers, talking, getting ready for the day, deepening their relationships of trust. And I imagine that that's one of the reasons also why, along with a good security plan, you actually did not have chaos in what was really an incredibly horrific situation. And so I think Ken Trump's notion of fundamentals, and then just to use a word that came from Cleveland, when there was a shooting in 2007, and the district built on Ken's good work when he worked there in the 90s, but decided that the issue is not just hardware. The issue is what in Cleveland they called humanware. How do we put a system in place in the school and the community so we reduce the likelihood that any of the types of problems would happen? And if they do happen, we're able to respond as in a healthy way as possible.
Christine Baylor, let me turn now to you and ask you about your coordination of safety and security for the Henrico County Public Schools in Virginia.
Well, what we do is we work very closely with the police and the fire department, and we've laid out a security and safety plan that I think is very much like what they had in Connecticut. So I mean, what Ken said, I think is exactly right. You have to start with the fundamentals. I think you really it really goes way beyond bricks and mortar. I mean, you can harden the target at the schools, but you really have to build a culture of safety and security in the schools. And the principals have to be committed to it because they're the ones, you know, they have boots on the ground. They're the ones who actually carry it out.
And, of course, that's exactly what you had in Connecticut. So the question becomes, do schools around the country have to go even further? Christine.
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to look at every single situation and see what you can learn from it. I think generally what happens in every tragedy, people suddenly jump to try to put a Band-Aid on it, try to have a fix. And I think that what we have to do is we have to take some time and take a longer look at it. We have some very vocal people who want a police officer in every school. We have, you know, and I'm not sure that the silent majority really wants that. I think you have to find a balance with a welcoming school and a safe school. And I think we have to work at continuing to identify that balance.
All right.
And we're always open
to you
for
now,
suggestions.
Lucinda Roy, you teach at Virginia Tech, and you did, in fact, have some contact with the student who later gunned down 32 people in April of 2007. Talk about the contact you had with that young man.
I was chair of English in 2005 when he was first brought to my attention. I'd had him before in a class of 250 students, but I hadn't known him one-on-one very well. I had required writing, though, from all those students, so I'd got to know him a little bit, and I realized that he was a student that seemed to be very sensitive. He'd contacted me earlier, and he'd told me that he was writing a novel and he wanted an agent. And there was something in his note that made me realize that he seemed to be very vulnerable. So when I responded to him, I made sure that I told him that it was important to know that there were various other things he probably needed to do first before sending out his novel.
You used the word vulnerable. Can you expand on that?
Well, after you've been in teaching for a long time, you get to recognize certain signs. And one of the signs is often that people are very down on themselves when they say that they've got huge ambitions but almost no feeling that they're going to be able to accomplish them. And when you see that kind of disconnect, when you see that huge chasm between the yearning and the ability, then you need to look very carefully.
But aren't there a lot of students who might fall into that category? Were there other signs that troubled you?
There were other signs, and they really erupted after he was in a poetry class in the fall of 2005 when he wrote a poem that seemed to be aimed at the class and seemed to be threatening to the professor, Nikki Giovanni. So she reported that to me. I was chair of the English department. At that time, there was only one real option at Virginia Tech. You had to transfer the student out of the class into another class. I didn't feel that that was acceptable because I wasn't quite certain how safe that would be. So I asked him to come to my office, and I sat with him and the assistant chair, because I never do that kind of thing by myself. And we had an interview, and he showed up in his sunglasses that he wore indoors most of the time, a cap, and he spoke in a whisper that was so quiet that it was almost impossible to hear him. And then you need to contrast that with the fact that he kind of shouted his poem in the class. So there was, again, that disconnect, which is why I got in touch with the Virginia Tech Police, the college, the Student Affairs Office Counseling Services, and I had a protocol that I developed because I was very concerned about troubled students, and we'd had some before.
And what happened as a result of your references to those other groups?
Well, unfortunately, he hadn't made any explicit threats. And I think that this is something we need to remember, that it's very easy to say, yes, we need to respond with extreme measures in these cases and intervene. But if someone hasn't made an explicit threat, it can be hard to do so. I still felt that he needed to go to counseling services, but I couldn't persuade counseling services that that was something that needed to happen. So my only option was to try to persuade him myself, I felt. So I met with him, and we'd work on his novel eventually a little bit, and on his poetry, and write together. And then at the end, he did tell me that he was going to counseling, and he did actually seek out counseling, not just once. He sought them out at least a couple of times.
Were you totally taken aback by his ultimate action?
I actually felt at the beginning that he seemed to be so depressed that he could possibly be suicidal. I also did not feel safe myself, and I made that pretty clear to counseling services that was, it seemed to me that this was somebody who was not always in control. And sometimes silence is a manifestation of shyness, and other times it seems to be a manifestation of menace. And it was both of those things. And it wasn't till later, years later, that we learned that he suffered from selective mutism after the tragedy, which is a condition that does not allow you to speak in certain social situations. And many people suffer from it, and I want to make it absolutely clear that this is not an indication of some kind of predilection for violence. It's not. But he did suffer from it, which meant that he'd been virtually silent since the age of 3. So when I learned that, I was really surprised, to tell you the truth, that he and I had been able to write together and work together, to some extent at least. It was very difficult, though, and that's why I wrote about it afterwards. It's very difficult when you write a book like I did, because most people don't want to talk about this issue. And so when I wrote No Right to Remain Silent, I think that some people still feel it was something we should never have spoken about. I actually feel we've got to get into the conversation, because these young, crazed boys are online talking about this all the time, and nobody is providing a counter-narrative. And we really need to be aware of that, and we need to plan for the future. But I have to say, I am more hopeful than I have been in 5 years.
Why?
Because for the first time, people are waking up. for 5 years, some of us, and I would include the guests that you're having on this program today, have been saying there is a terrible problem with mental health services. There is a terrible problem with unpreparedness in schools. We are not ready to respond to these students. We are getting cuts in education. Teachers are not valued. Teachers are brave often, as has been testified in the past few days. We have to have a renaissance in education in the United States of America. I think President Obama is ready to do that. And I think for the first time, the NRA has taken a step backwards, which gives us all a chance to take a step forwards and say, we're really going to cherish our children and find a way through this. And there are things we can do.
Lucinda Roy, she's a distinguished professor at Virginia Tech. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David Osher, you want to comment?
Yes, as Lucinda said, we have lots of brave and lots of sensitive teachers. What we really need is a capacity so that when a teacher notices something, one can get the support. And there are two things I was hearing in what Lucinda was saying. On the one hand, we need the ability when somebody exhibits warning signs, and warning signs are not necessarily predictive of bad things, for people who have professional capacity to assess that. In addition, we need the capacity to do threat assessments, to understand when somebody really is a threat. Let me add that I really share Lucinda's optimism, and I share it not just because of the mental health issues, but over the last 2 years, an increasing number of people are starting to understand that social-emotional factors, social-emotional learning, what some people call non-cognitive factors, are important. And at the same time, there's an increasing interest in creating supportive school climates, and a part of that is not just removing students because of their behavior, but rather giving them support so you really do create a more supportive and safer place in schools.
We are going to be talking even more tomorrow about mental health issues in this country and certainly the factors in which they played into this tragedy. But Christine Baylor, I want to come back to you and ask you whether you believe an armed guard in each school throughout the country, as Bill Bennett has called for, makes sense.
I hope we never get to that point. I certainly agree with Ken Trump that it makes a lot of sense. And when we do that here in Henrico County, have a school resource officer who is a Henrico police officer in every high school and every middle school. And they are there. And we also have an unarmed security officer. And the two together, the unarmed security officer deals with matters of the code of conduct, and the armed police officer deals with law enforcement. So the two together really provide a complete security package. In our elementary schools, our officers are really there. We have school resource officers who serve a number of schools, so we don't have one per school. But they're there really for education and to get students used to police officers, because in some homes, the only time they see a police officer is when the officer responds to the home for a domestic situation.
All right, and Lucinda, do you agree that we should not be thinking about armed guards at schools, or do you think we should consider that even more seriously?
And I guess the way I would answer that is to say, supposing we took out the children from the classroom and we put instead, say, $10,000 in each seat, and we said, we're not going to guard this, we're just going to leave it there. I think most people would be horrified and say, you must be crazy. This is a crazy thing to do. People will come in and take the money, and you will not have it there. We guard our banks all the time. I actually do not see anything wrong with guarding our children in much the same way as we would guard our money, knowing that they are our greatest treasures. Do I like that idea? No. Do I think that teachers should be armed? Absolutely not, because it takes away their focus from the children. But I do think we need to think very carefully about being aware of idealizing the learning situation. Our learning communities are not safe. Many of us have been saying this for some time. So if there are 300 million guns in America, and if we know once in a while a parent is not going to be responsible, then it's not just the inside of the classroom we need to be worried about. It's also what's happening in the community. I don't trust every gun owner to be sensible with their guns. I don't. And so if I don't, then therefore I need to think of some things to protect the children.
Lucinda Roy, an alumna and distinguished professor at Virginia Tech. Short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
More than 18 million Americans are compulsive buyers, an addiction that can destroy families and bank accounts. The struggle to control shopping addiction. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As we talk about school safety, we're going to open the phones now. First to Alex in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi. I just wanted to comment on, you know, the safety aspect. I have a first grader and a kindergartner. And, you know, the security in these schools, you know, there's a buzzer, there's that, like was already mentioned, but, you know, these doors need to be reinforced, because if you look at the outcomes of these things, everything happens in the first 5-10 minutes. Once the police get on the scene, often these things end. So you need to be able to protect these kids, you know, barrier them into these classrooms where they'll be safe. I happen to be an ER physician, and on the mental health aspect, I'm glad that people are talking about it. It's hard enough to get people who have diagnosed conditions into proper treatment, let alone fringe people. So I'm glad that we're starting to discuss these topics, because it's not just about firearms. you know, firearms are a tool. It's the person that pulls the trigger. And I know that's the rhetoric that everyone, you know, oh, he's a crazy person. But at end of the day, we need to, A, protect the teachers and the students, and, B, get these people on the fringes into mental health.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Just before the break, Lucinda Roy, you said you agreed to a certain extent with Bill Bennett about the use of an armed guard in each school. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
And I was really referring to school resource officers that are in middle school and high school. I actually think they should be in elementary school too. But I want to make it really clear that I do not think that adding more guns to the equation is going to make for safer schools, ultimately. It's not. The most important thing to think about is that we need a real cultural change here. It's not just about security issues. It's about how we think about students. So, for example, one of the main questions we have to ask ourselves is, who should intervene and when? We should also ask ourselves what risks are involved when one does intervene. So, for example, if you intervene with a troubled student, you know that it's quite possible you may be putting yourself at risk, you may be putting your staff at risk. I felt that I was doing that in the English department to some extent by meeting with him. What kind of resources can you rely on? Could you be, for years to come, in all kinds of liability cases because you have intervened too much? Don't you need some training in order to do that well? There are cultural things that we need to do. And maybe more importantly than anything is we need to really start talking to these young people. Nobody is asking them, are you unhappy? Are you depressed? What are you thinking about? People are not doing that. And I realized when I was talking with Sungwi Cho, the shooter at Virginia Tech, I believe I was probably the first person, perhaps outside of his family, to ask him those questions. I think people have to ask those questions.
Here's an email from Amy in Yorktown, Virginia. She says, according to this morning's paper, our governor, Bob McDonald, says, quote, lawmakers should discuss the possibility, unquote, of allowing school staff to carry guns as part of a larger debate on school safety. Christine Baylor, what's your reaction?
My initial reaction is that I would not be in support of that, that anybody would carry a gun in a school unless they are trained law enforcement, because law enforcement officers get trained over and over and over again. And I can't imagine that we would put teachers through that same kind of training, that same level of training.
All right. To San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Paul.
Yeah, Diane, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to reflect some of the, some of the same issues the professor brought up. But, this is an incredibly nuanced question and problem. But this is kind of a 9/11 for us. And I think that here in San Antonio, we have police officers in the high school level as a substation to respond to the other schools. And we'll probably hear people bringing this up to put more officers in the middle schools and the elementary schools as well. But, we guard our money, like she said, with armed people, because fanatics, they look at things, and despite them being not mentally stable, they still have a capacity for thinking. And if a target is hardened, they will think twice about trying to hit it. And I have the benefit of years of military and medical experience, and also the emergency physician that called in. We have officers in the emergency department for the same issue, same reasons, because you can't predict this. And I don't think the mental health question is going to be solved very quickly in this country. So I think, like 9/11, we need to take measures to protect our most precious resource.
David Osher.
I think we need security. And at the same time, if we look at the statistics, schools are very safe places. What we need is trying to minimize the possibilities that somebody like that disturbed young man shows up. And if we get sucked into an overemphasis on thinking that just putting another officer, no matter how trained, or a piece of weaponry in a school is going to eliminate things, we're deluding ourselves. If I read correctly from the Connecticut State Police, they said given the level of armament that that young man had, if they had come in, they could not have probably stopped him sooner. To make just one last point, when I had the privilege of being leading the federal government's response as a contractor to the shootings in the 1990s and were asked to do early warning signs, our internal conversation in the expert panel that the White House had asked was, we don't want to know that somebody's warning when he shows up with an Uzi wearing combat fatigues. We want to really help someone much earlier so we're never at that point that we have to worry about a shootout in a school.
Senator Barbara Boxer spoke this morning. She said, we have to pass common sense gun control laws, but what I call the in-the-meantime strategy is this. We have to keep our children safe. So she's introducing two bills. The first is called the School Safety Enhancement Act to provide schools with more resources and create a joint task force to develop advisory guidelines to protect schools. Second, a bill is called Save Our Students that would allow governors to use the National Guard to use personnel to help support local law enforcement agencies in protecting children at schools. We spend over $600 billion on national defense. What are we doing to protect our children? Not enough. Isn't it part of our national defense to keep our children safe? What's your reaction to having the National Guard help out Lucinda Roy?
I can understand why. Barbara Box is a wonderful politician, and I can see why she would think that that might be a good idea in certain circumstances. They have to be able to respond, and it can be overwhelming to campus police to try to have to respond to these kinds of things and to local officers. But I do want to emphasize, building off of what David said that I thought was so important, we have to balance our response to these things. And unfortunately, the focus is very often on those last few minutes when the gunman comes to campus and then starts shooting. And we start to think of all the things that we can do in those last 11 minutes. But in fact, what we should be thinking about is all the things we could do in, say, Sung Wee Cho's case for the 23 years before that. There were many moments, windows of opportunity, where people could intervene. And they actually intervened very successfully when he was in middle school, when he was fantasizing about Columbine. But when he got to 18, he decided he wasn't going to take his medication anymore. It became much more difficult to intervene. But even in 2005, he was ready to seek help. So we need to make sure that we've got those mechanisms in place so that we can intervene.
But if we can, for a moment, put the mental health issues aside, because I understand that they are at the root of what has happened. What can we do immediately to make our schools safer? Christine Baylor.
I just think that if you put an armed guard in a school, that what tends to happen is that people become dependent on that person to be everything that they want in security, and they stop being vigilant. I would much rather see thousands of eyes and ears out there from teachers and administrators and even students. We like our students to be vigilant, and they often tell us when somebody is on a playground that shouldn't be there. We want to keep that vigilance. We want to continue to build that culture of safety and security inside the school, and we want to get parents involved in our schools. We want them to be there and be volunteers and help us add to the number of eyes and ears that we have in the schools.
So from your perspective, David Osher, what kind of further training of teachers, for example, would you embark on?
I think we want to train teachers both regarding how to build a supportive school environment so young people feel safe coming forth if they're worried about themselves or other people. We also want to make sure that teachers know what warning signs are, not so that they resolve them, but rather they also know what can happen and who do you go to and that there will be backup. We also want to make sure that they're aware of the fact that there are a variety of vulnerabilities among their students. And if I can, let me give you resources that are on. There's a national, the federal government created the National Center for Safe and Supportive Schools. And on that center, there right now are links to resources for what schools can do right now, including links to sites regarding the security measures. But I think the important thing is to see our teachers and the adults as resources, make sure that they know how they can respond to students, help them integrate that into their teaching. This cannot be a choice between teaching and safety. It has to be a combination. And as Christine said, it's these young people and the teachers and the principals are the eyes for safety.
Lucinda Roy, it sounds to me as though you did everything you could possibly have done to help that young man, to alert others to the potential for danger, to suggest alternative means for helping him, and nothing worked.
It didn't work, and that, of course, is the burden that I carry. And you could argue that perhaps I was not persuasive enough. I try to make sure, though, that what I'm doing and what other people need to do is focus on what is possible now. I think that there are two main things we could do immediately. We could train more teachers and bring them into the classroom. A good teacher makes a tremendous difference, and we could help parents who are struggling on their own and who may well be even afraid of their children. We need to help them.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air. Dan, are you there? All right, let's go to Waynesville, North Carolina. Sonia, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
My husband is a retired school teacher, and therefore we have spent a great deal of time sharing our thoughts about the situation. And we have come to a mutual understanding that other than these threatening defensive tools, teachers with guns, guards, and vests, there's a need for a supportive cultural change, we believe. Beginning with preschool and continuing through the school years, using full class hours each day to explore ways toward conflict resolution, self-awareness, and assertiveness. Fortunately, in 11th grade, I had to take a class in which I was able to think and write about my family's values and whether my values were the same as theirs. And it was so helpful for me just that one year in understanding how life works. So that's it for me.
All right. Thank you for calling. And finally, an email from Christy in Indianapolis, who says, my children came home yesterday from their public elementary school telling me they had a red alert drill where they practiced hiding in the classroom with the door locked and the lights out. My 8-year-old was proud that he had found the best hiding spot. She says, it breaks my heart that this is what we have come to in America, practicing hiding from a gunman. So do we simply teach kids that schools are no longer safe? What do we tell our young people in terms of, now I'm talking about kindergartners and first graders and second graders, what do we tell them, David Osher?
I think we tell them what the heroic teachers at the school where the tragedy was told them, that we will keep you safe And what, again, sounds to be the case was that the little children really felt that. They did feel protected in that terror situation. Now, what we also have to do, as you've been, we're talking about today, is deal with the fact that we don't want people with guns making them unsafe. But it's important for young people to know that teachers have their backs and that their fellow students have their backs. And together, they can learn, that they can support each other, that they can be healthy.
David Osher of the American Institutes for Research, Lucinda Roy, an alumni and distinguished professor at Virginia Tech. She's author of the novel Lady Moses and several books of poetry. And Christine Baylor, coordinator for safety and security at Henrico County Public Schools in Virginia. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurov-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.